From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with writer and gay activist Armistead Maupin. His new book, Significant Others, satirizes gay and straight relationships. Also today, I'll talk with political cartoonist Doug Marlette, who also does the strip Kudzu. His new book, There's No Business Like Soul Business, spoofs TV evangelism. Jazz critic Francis Davis reviews a new Tony Bennett reissue. It's an anthology of Bennett's recordings with jazz musicians. And TV critic David Bianculli examines how well Garrison Keillor has translated to television. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is social satirist and gay activist Armistead Maupin. He writes a newspaper serial in the San Francisco Examiner that satirizes gay, straight, and bisexual lifestyles. His new book, adapted from the serial, is called Significant Others. It's the fifth volume in his Tales of the City series. Significant Others satirizes the impulse to get away from the opposite sex. Three men are off to spend a few days alone in a cabin in the woods. A lesbian couple leaves for Womenwood, an all-women's music festival. And the stepfather of one of the lesbians vacations at Bohemian Grove, which is like a summer camp for male movers and shakers to get away from their wives and relax with each other. These three worlds collide in the woods outside San Francisco. Maupin is a veteran of the Vietnam War and received a presidential commendation for his work with disabled vets. He grew up in a conservative Republican family in Raleigh, North Carolina. Like many of his characters, he's leading a very different lifestyle since coming out and moving to San Francisco. We'll be talking about adult subject matter, so listener discretion is advised. Armistead Maupin, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks a lot, Terry.
Is it hard writing a sex comedy in the age of AIDS? And let me explain for our listeners that in your book, one character has AIDS. One character has tested positive for the antibody, and a third character is waiting for his test to come back.
Right. Well, yes and no, in that I think humor is a marvelous outlet for me because my life has certainly felt the weight of AIDS as much as any person I know. I'm a gay man who lives in San Francisco. I've had 20 friends who have died in the last 3 years. So I try to draw on the natural kinds of humor that arise day to day, the curious little ironies that somehow or other enable us to laugh through the worst of tragedies. I also think it's very important that the general population find ways in which to laugh when life is so dark and grim, I guess much in the way that Busby Berkeley needed to be around when the Depression was there.
Well, I think there's a lot of examples in your book about how you can find things to laugh at even in the face of tragedy. And I'd like you to read a selection from the book Significant Others.
Sure. The bit I'm going to read here is from a chapter entitled Member in Good Standing. It's about a man named Michael Tolliver who's 34 years old, who's gay, who has tested positive for the virus, and who is a nurseryman, essentially, but who stays quite wrapped up in his work. The busyness of business helped him to forget how much he missed what had come to be known as the unsafe exchange of bodily fluids. If he remained idle too long, his euphoric past could creep up on him like a Frenchman pushing postcards, a portfolio of fading erotica fully capable of breaking his nostalgic heart. It wasn't just an epidemic anymore, it was a famine, a starvation of the spirit which sooner or later afflicted everyone. Some people capitulated to the terror, turning inward in their panic, avoiding the gaze of strangers on the street. Others adopted a sort of earnest gay fraternalism, enacting the rituals of safe-sex orgies with all the clinical precision of young pioneers dismantling their automatic weapons. Lots of people found relief on the telephone, mutually master-charging until nirvana was achieved. Phone sex, Michael had observed, not only toned the imagination, but provided men with an option that had heretofore been unavailable to them, faking an orgasm. Michael himself had once faked an orgasm over the telephone. Unable to come, yet mindful of his manners, he had growled out his ecstasy for at least half a minute, pounding on his headboard for added effect. His partner, someone in Teaneck, New Jersey, had been so audibly appreciative of the performance that Michael fell asleep afterwards, feeling curiously satiated.
Thanks for reading that. That's Armistead Maupin, a selection from his new book, Significant Others. Do you feel like, in a way, you have to fight against desexualization in the age of AIDS, this, like, fear of sex in general,
sure.
In addition to just fear of the disease?
Yeah, not just on a personal level, but it's part of my crusade when I travel around to remind people that sex is a beautiful, God-given thing, and that sex is very much in the mind. I mean, the whole... We keep hearing safe sex, and that's equated with condoms repeatedly. Well, if condoms certainly may play an important role, but I think people have got to get much more creative in terms of their sexual behavior. I think curiously enough, or maybe not curiously enough, that gay men have been better equipped to do this all along because of the, even before the AIDS epidemic, we had a rather imaginative variety of sexual activities, many of which we could fall back on when, say, anal sex became clearly a dangerous behavior. Sex can be a very voyeuristic thing. There can be all forms of the touch. Different parts of the body can be eroticized if you become aware that sex is very, very much in the mind. And I think that's an important thing for everyone to learn, especially now in this very dangerous era.
You seem to be mourning, in a way, a lost sense of tribalism in the gay male community since the outbreak of AIDS.
I think that's true. You know, for all I think a lot of heterosexuals who didn't know the ways in which homosexual bathhouses worked, for instance, were horrified by the fact of them. But my memory of that experience is one of, it was a democratizing process for me. I learned a lot about other people. I learned that you could tell a nice guy and a bastard in the dark. I learned a lot about myself sexually in those bathhouse situations. And I think that the ways in which people came together and met other people, because they weren't just places for sex. They had huge TV lounges. They had steam rooms. You could go there and the cares of the world would slip away in a single evening and you'd feel regenerated the next day. And matter of fact, I had a lot of straight male friends who said they wished that an equivalent thing had existed for them. And that tribalism was very much a part of, I think, so much of the gay freedom movement grew out of the fact that people drew together for sexual purposes and then realized that they had political and spiritual reasons to bond together.
Because there are so many fears of homosexuality in our culture, a lot of gays have, until they were really out, felt guilty about their sexual feelings. Are you afraid that AIDS is, in a way, exploiting guilt and sex, that kind of bond between guilt and sex?
I think, yes, in a way. I think some people will fall prey to that. At the same time, AIDS is opening up the discussion of homosexuality for the first time ever. I mean, the national news media is now having to do its homework on the subject. In the past, most members of the press would say, I think, that they felt a responsibility to simply keep it under wraps because it wasn't for general consumption. And there were a lot of gay people within the media who felt the same way, who were remaining silent about it, who were keeping gay people invisible. And I think that very invisibility is what has created the ignorance in this country that has made this great cloud of superstition and fear surround AIDS. And the more we can communicate, the more we can be visible as gay people, the less ignorance there will be.
Social satirist Armistead Maupin is my guest. He's the author of the new book, Significant Others. One of the themes in your new book is this desire for people of each sex to separate themselves from people of the other sex. And you have gay and straight versions and bisexual versions of showing up in the book. Why was this an interesting subject for you to play with?
Well, I had a friend who was a member of the Bohemian Grove, which is this stuffy male enclave that you mentioned. And I'd always been fascinated about it. It played a minor role in my first book, but I'd never really gotten in there to see it. This friend took me in there during off-season when the encampment wasn't going on. And what I saw was this amazing, it was an astonishing thing, 120 different camps in this ancient redwood grove that looked for all the world like boys' camps. And yet Henry Kissinger and William Buckley and George Shultz and Ronald Reagan all go there to play once a year for 2 weeks. A lot of the folks stay there the entire time and they stay drunk and they when they put on huge pageants and men play the women's roles. And then at the same time, I was watching the growth of the Women's Music Festival phenomenon around the country, which was fascinating to me in the very same way. So I thought it might be interesting to draw parallels, because I think it's a very natural instinct on the part of people of both sexes to want to spend some time only with their own sex. I think it may be something that's built into us. The problem comes when we become so rigid about it that we try to enforce it to the limit. And that's also where the humor comes, I think. So I've tried to exploit that as much as possible in the story.
Well, you get off a lot of humor in the section about the lesbian retreat, this women's festival, and you call it the Womenwood Music Festival, and it's spelled W-I-M-M-I-N, and there have been a lot of women's festivals and women's books that have respelled the word women. Why did you respell that in your title?
Well, for the very reason it seemed likely that they would do it. I've seen a lot of pamphlets from women's music festivals, and they do spell it either W-I-M-M-I-N or W-O-M-Y-N, which is even more confusing. Of course, the point is to get men out of the picture entirely, to take it out of the word. So a lot of I had to issue not a disclaimer, but a certificate of authenticity, I guess, at the beginning of the book that indicated that most of the details that I provide actually come directly from those organizations. I'm not making this stuff up.
One of the things you get into is what is probably a dilemma for women who have sons, but also like to go to women-exclusive retreats or conferences. And one woman explains to another in your book that boys over 10 can't go to this music festival. And she says, I told him they made that rule about little boys because 10-year-old boys were almost men, and men were all rapists at heart.
Well, in the context of the story, that's a bit of a joke. She's saying that to her lover and teasing her with that comment. She doesn't believe that. I mean, she in any full sense of the word. But it is true that that boys are, in fact, banned from these festivals, that they're meant to be women for women-only space, and that means that little boys don't get to go. I guess usually they don't bring them at all, but most of them do provide a separate compound for the boys where the boys get to fraternize with each other. Significant Others plays a little bit with what happens when these little boys get together and form their own community. It's a sort of way of saying anytime you set up a sexually exclusive society, it's going to backfire on you in some way or another.
You are poking fun at lesbians in the book, and we live in a culture where there's a lot of self-deprecating humor, and it's usually accepted as an in-group kind of thing. If you're a Jewish person, you could talk about Jews. If you're a black person, you could talk about blacks. If you're a lesbian, you could talk about lesbians. You're a kind of insider-outsider here because you're a gay man, so you're homosexual. But on the other hand, you're not a gay woman, so I wonder how women have reacted to the satire of lesbians in your book.
Yeah, Rita Mae Brown once called me a lesbian trapped in a faggot's body. I like to think that's true. I think I'm a human being trapped in a faggot's body, and as a human being, I can imagine how a lesbian or a straight person or anybody else could think in a given circumstance. I'm not poking fun at lesbians at all. I'm making fun of an institution here. Just as I wrote about gay men going to the National Gay Rodeo about 5 years ago and had great fun with the whole concept of a gay rodeo. I think most women who've read the book, well, I can't generalize about that, most who've spoken to me, all who have spoken to me, said they enjoyed it a great deal and actually found their own experience echoed in the book. I tell the story through the eyes of my lesbian character. I'm not passing judgment as an outsider, although obviously if my plumbing is held against me, I'm not really qualified to speak about it. But if my heart is in the right place, I think I did a good job.
One of the lesbians has a stepfather who goes to this Bohemian Grove, and he's part of the quote, ruling class of America. And she is therefore distrusted. She tries to keep this a secret, that she has a stepfather who is this arch conservative. And I wonder if you had to go through something like that yourself, since you're from a staunchly Republican background.
Yes. Well, I've never tried to keep it a secret, but sometimes when people find out, they're shocked. I'm shocked to even think that I'm in the same family. The character in the book is a member of the President's Battle Monuments Commission, and as such was one of the people who went with Reagan to lay wreaths on Nazi graves during the so-called reconciliation ceremony at Bitburg. My father has done just that sort of a thing. And so we're about as far apart as two people could possibly be, although we love each other. So I play with that a little bit in the book.
Did you ever feel that your credentials as a gay activist were going to be questioned if people found out about your father being conservative?
I think my credentials as a gay activist are even stronger because I came from that kind of a background, because I rose above that and became something else. The people I distrust are the ones who were raised in completely liberal families and their activism is just a part of their tradition. It wasn't a tough thing for them to do. I came further than other people have had to come, so I think I see things a little more clearly. I hope so, anyway.
My guest is Armistead Maupin, and he's the author of the new satire, Significant Others. We're going to talk some more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is social satirist and gay activist Armistead Maupin. He's the author of the new book, Significant Others, which satirizes gay, straight, and bisexual lifestyles. In your new book, there's a famous lesbian poet and I think playwright who is known within the gay community as being gay, but to the straight world she's not. And when she goes on the Johnny Carson show or all the talk shows, she talks about feminism, but she doesn't talk about the fact that she's a lesbian.
Right.
It made me think about Rock Hudson only because in the gay world, I think people knew that he was gay, but most of his heterosexual fans had no idea of it. Now, I know that you were friends with him.
Yes.
Did you talk to him about that? Did you feel like he had an obligation to talk about being gay, to come out?
I'm not sure about an obligation, but I felt that he would be extremely effective if he had come out. I talked to him as early as 1976 about it and felt that, since his career was at a certain point where he had moved beyond the heartthrob leading man and was sort of playing more presidential roles, that it wouldn't hurt him if he did it the right way, that he could have done a biography then that would have explained his life and which would have had a huge impact on the public concept of what it means to be homosexual, which would have freed a lot of other actors from this terrible yoke of having to be one thing while appearing to be another. That still goes on, of course, today, even more rampantly than ever before. We have young gay stars in Hollywood, now in the age of AIDS, who are, you know, frantically finding lesbian actresses to marry and create a heterosexual appearance. So I had hoped that Rock might have been able to do that, but I'm not sure that it was ever in his nature. He was a good guy privately, but he didn't have very much of a social consciousness when it came to any sort of oppressed minority. He was very much a Republican, in fact.
What kind of answer would he give you when you'd suggest to him that it would be helpful to others as well as to him if he came out?
Well, he was kind of fascinated, but he had a kind of rambunctious side to him that made me think that he might do it, simply because at one point in his life he just decided the public charade wasn't going to go on anymore. He made no bones about taking male dates to restaurants in Hollywood, for instance. But I think he just didn't feel it was possible. And at the time I brought it up, he was with his lover, who was very much interested in keeping the lid on, and the excuse he used was, not until my mother dies, which I always thought was kind of amusing, the idea that here was this man living with the sex symbol of the Western world, but some old lady in Peoria somewhere could never be allowed to find out about it.
Well, do you think that a lot of our contemporary heterosexual sex symbols are really gay, and that fans would be really surprised if they found out?
Oh, there's no question about it. There's absolutely no question about it. Many, many of them are. In fact, many of the ones who are the most popular with women are the gay ones, the ones who are most popular with women and some of the most attractive ones.
Does it make you laugh or make you angry?
it makes me angry now. It used to make me laugh. It makes me angry now because we are deliberately creating a one-sided image of what it means to be homosexual in this country, and that one-sided image is now allowing people to die while a government sits by and remains inactive. Ronald Reagan knew better than anybody else that Hollywood was full of gay people and that some of the biggest cowboy studs in town were gay, and yet he remained silent long after an old friend's diagnosis had been announced. So I think it's unforgivable. I mean, I think that our government's inaction is going to be considered the single greatest act of humanity of the 20th century. I think he's going to have a lot to answer for.
Your strip, Significant Others, which when you worked for a different newspaper was called Tales of the City, it has a real big following in San Francisco, but I'm sure that it's not just a gay following. I'm sure there's a very mixed following who reads it. Do you see it as a consciousness, excuse the dry word there, but a consciousness raising tool in a way?
Yeah, I do. I do very much. You know, Dickens, when he serialized his work in the 19th century, was able to address a large number of social issues that people might not have been concerned about if he hadn't presented it to them in an entertainment format. You can get much more done by sort of slipping into the consciousness of your readers and making them care about the characters, and then the social issues that the characters become involved in become real to these people for the very first time. Long before there was AIDS, Michael Tolliver, my gay character, came down with a paralyzing disease in 1977, and I received letters of condolence and flowers and sympathy cards from people who invariably identified themselves as straight and said, "Please don't kill Michael Tolliver. We love him as if he were a member of our own family." Well, I think that people can feel that way about homosexuals if real-life homosexuals just make themselves known to their gay friends, to their straight friends, rather.
Was it hard for you to come out? You now would like people who are gay to come out and be public about it.
It was very hard for me, and I waited a long time, and I'm here to say that I regret every moment I wasted. I regret every moment of it because my life did not become real and rich and fulfilled until I was out of the closet. And then I found love coming from so many different directions. I found the most extraordinary intimacy with my straight friends who felt the need to confess suddenly every sin that they had ever... I learned more about their lives than I ever thought that I would know.
Why did you bring this out in them? Oh, because you had come out
well,
and they were
the idea
confess?
Is when you tell someone you're gay, a straight person usually thinks, well, this is the worst thing anyone can possibly confess, so my little sin can't mean that much. And so they share things with you. And so whereas in the past I might have been nervous about having friendships with, say, heterosexual men for the fear that they might find out I was gay or they might think I was coming on to them, now, with the cards are all on the table, it's wonderful. We get to, you know, stay up and shoot the bull all night long, and I really feel very close to them. And we share a kind of bond as men that I think lesbians share with straight women. And it's always made me a little bit sad that men, there isn't some sort of male equivalent of feminism, some sort of umbrella concept that allows straight men and gay men to talk about what it feels like to be a man in America.
That's a really interesting point.
There are some groups now. There are men's groups, as they call them. But I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong, but I get the impression they sit around and beat on drums and discuss their forefathers.
When you came out, were you in San Francisco already?
Yeah, more or less. I'd had a few squalid, in my mind, sexual experiences in Charleston, South Carolina, where it was very closeted. But it wasn't until I got to San Francisco where the heterosexuals were so comfortable with homosexuality that I felt free to be myself. I mean, I confessed, in quotes, my homosexuality to my best friend in town, who was a straight lady with two kids, and her first reaction to it was, big deal, you know. Who cares? I know plenty of gay guys. What's the problem?
It's a pretty unusual reaction for a few years ago.
It was very unusual for 1971, but it made a big difference in my life because I figured that I was the one that was causing my problems by worrying about it, that what I really needed to do was to be honest and find people who would be comfortable with me. Because if you're going to lose somebody when you come out of the closet, you're not going to really lose anybody that's going to matter to you in the first place. You're going to lose narrow, bigoted people whose own lives are not worth emulating. And the people you gain are so much better. They're the cream of the crop.
San Francisco was for a long time a place where a lot of gays from around the country would go to come out because they knew there was a community they could fit into and that it would be more accepted there than it would be in, for instance, a small town. Is that still the case with AIDS the way it is? Because, you know, whenever there's a program about AIDS on one of the networks, New York and San Francisco, the two cities that are mentioned, and I wonder how it's affected San Francisco as a symbol of a kind of retreat for gays.
Yeah, I think it's still a symbol in a way because of the civilized attitude there about AIDS, for instance. The community is thoroughly united, the press and the politicians, and there is no disagreement as to what to be done. As a consequence, people come from all over the world just to study the way San Francisco has handled the AIDS problem. I've thought about this myself because you live with it so much. It's so difficult seeing people dying around you. I've thought about, well, should I move somewhere else? Is there a way to get away from this? The answer is no. It's a virus. And if your friends are gay, then some of them will be carrying the virus and some will not. And the real choice is, where can I be that the society around me is going to be the most comfortable about it? And the answer is still San Francisco.
It sounds like it is kind of hard, maybe, to write comedy during this period.
It's tough to examine your life closely. I guess that's the way to put it. It's tough to try to get your emotions down on paper. I cry a lot when I write, but I get it out. I have an outlet for it. I think I'd be a lot angrier and sadder person if I didn't have these stories to write.
I'm going to ask you something very trivial here. One of the characters in Significant Others looks at himself in the mirror, admires his mustache, and says, I'm glad I didn't shave this off even when the new wave look came in. And for our listeners who can't see you, you are sporting a nice bushy mustache yourself.
That is really funny. Last night, I read that passage at a bookstore, and I told my lover afterwards, you know, that's the only passage in the entire book that embarrasses me because it feels so autobiographical. And I know they're just sitting there looking at me and saying, well, does he look all that good in a mustache? I really was trying to talk through the character, but I guess part of it was me. I identify with all of the characters. Curiously enough, I felt closer to Dee Dee this time around.
Are you going to shave the mustache?
I don't think so. My lover likes it, so I guess he's the one I got to please.
You have a lovely inscription for him at the beginning of the book. You write to him that he took... What
for Terry, who took his time getting here.
That's really lovely, I think.
Well, it's the way I felt. I'm 43 years old, and I spent the greater part of my 30s looking for someone who was big as romantic as I was, and I finally found him. He met me at a plane in Atlanta when I was on a speaking tour. And 3 minutes after I'd met him, I felt as if I'd known him all my life. And he makes life a lot easier for me.
Well, I wish you the best, and I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Terry.
My guest has been writer Armistead Maupin, and he writes a daily serial in the San Francisco Examiner that satirizes gay and straight contemporary lifestyles. His new novel, Significant Others, is adapted from that serial. Significant Others is published by Harper & Row. This is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll talk with writer Richard Gilman. He's written a memoir about his conversion from Judaism to Catholicism to atheism. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, truth is stranger than fiction. Political cartoonist Doug Marlette discusses his satires of TV evangelism. Also, jazz critic Francis Davis reviews a new Tony Bennett reissue, a collection of his sessions with jazz musicians. TV critic David Bianculli says one of radio's most popular programs, A Prairie Home Companion, looks pretty good on TV, too. And we'll get a look at the day's news from National Public Radio in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, we have this news. This is Fresh Air. Now we have our weekly look at what's new in jazz. Singer Tony Bennett has had his greatest commercial successes with pop songs like I Left My Heart in San Francisco and I Want to Be Around. But from the very beginning of his career, there's also been another side to Tony Bennett. Our jazz critic Francis Davis has this review of the new album, Tony Bennett Jazz.
You're clear out of this world. When I'm looking at you, I hear out of this world the music that no mortal ever knew. You're right.
We could bicker all day, I suppose, about whether Tony Bennett is a jazz singer. The problem is that jazz singing is usually defined by example. Louis Armstrong, Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, you name your favorites and I'll name mine. But you see the problem. By limiting the discussion to examples, we arrive at a value judgment rather than a working definition. It reminds me of something the essayist Ellen Willis said about the feminist anti-porn movement. According to Willis, their argument boils down to this: what turns me on is erotica, what turns you on is smut. The corollary would be, what pleases me is jazz at its most creative, what pleases you is pop at its most banal. Obviously, we need a better definition than that. I'm not planning to offer one, and even if I were, I'm not sure my definition would include Tony Bennett. But finally, what does it matter whether he's a jazz singer? What really matters in all vernacular singing is taste in material and accompaniment, and the proper balance of emotion to technique. Tony Bennett is leagues ahead of most of his competitors on all these counts, and like most quality pop singers, there's a little bit of Louis Armstrong in the way he hears and responds to rhythm. Bennett is to Frank Sinatra as Ella Fitzgerald is to Billie Holiday, which is to say that he's a consummate performer, but he doesn't drag deep, so he's not the stuff of which cult figures are made. In other words, there's a tendency to take Tony Bennett for granted, and I don't think we should. Columbia has just issued a two-record anthology called Tony Bennett Jazz. It draws from sessions recorded between 1954 and 1967 with top-name jazz instrumentalists like Art Blakey, Stan Getz, Zoot Sims, Herbie Hancock, and the Count Basie Orchestra. Bennett holds his own in this fast company. Ironically, though, the tracks on which he comes closest to phrasing with jazz-like intimacy are two featuring just him and pianist Ralph Sharon, his longtime accompanist and arranger. Let's listen to one of those tracks now. This is Street of Dreams.
Love laughs at a king. Kings don't mean a thing on the street of dreams. Dreams broken in two can be made like new on the street of dreams. Gold, silver, and gold, all you can hold is in the moonbeams. Poor, no one is poor. as love is sure, on the street of dreams. Poor, no one is poor. As love is sure on the street of dreams.
Tony Bennett at his absolute best, singing Street of Dreams from the new two-record anthology Tony Bennett Jazz. It's a marvelous collection on the whole, even though it includes some dated arrangements. Is it really jazz? I don't know the answer, so I'll tell you what I do know. Jazz and pop once shared a common repertoire, the songs of Arlen, Berlin, Gershwin, Kern, Porter, Ellington. That's no longer true. Why it's no longer true is a complicated matter, but suffice it to say that jazz has changed in the wake of Charlie Parker and John Coltrane. Pop, too, has changed since Elvis Presley and the Beatles. It's probably too late to hope for a reconciliation, and I'm not altogether sure a reconciliation would be for the best at this point, but I am sure that there are few pleasures greater than the simple pleasure of hearing a beautiful song beautifully sung. Tony Bennett delivers that pleasure consistently, and it's a pleasure it would be foolish for jazz fans to forgo.
Francis Davis reviewed Tony Bennett Jazz. Davis is the author of In the Moment, Jazz in the 1980s. He also writes for The Atlantic and the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Crazy rhythm, here's the doorway. I'll go my way, you'll go your way. Crazy rhythm, from now on we're through. Here is where we have a showdown. I'm too high hat, you're too low down. Crazy rhythm, here's goodbye to you. They say that when a highbrow meets a lowbrow walking along Broadway, soon the highbrow, he has no brow. Ain't it a shame, and you're to blame? What's the use of prohibition? You produce the same condition. Crazy rhythm, I've gone crazy too.
You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is cartoonist Doug Marlette. He recently joined the editorial pages of the Atlanta Constitution, but for the past 15 years he had been drawing political cartoons for the Charlotte Observer. He's also one of the few cartoonists who does a regular syndicated cartoon strip. It's called Kudzu, and it features a small-time TV evangelist preacher named the Reverend Will B. Dunn. The Reverend is the star of Marlette's new book, There's No Business Like Soul Business. Marlette was born in Greensboro, North Carolina in 1949 and has always lived in the South. For years while at The Observer, he parodied two of Charlotte's most famous personalities, Jim and Tammy Faye Baker. I asked Marlette if the recent scandal surrounding the Bakers and the PTL Club was having the unintended effect of helping his career.
I have definitely been blessed as a cartoonist. I mean, I've told people this is a miracle. I mean, it's like manna from heaven for the cartoonist. But yeah, that actually, though, you know, I had drawn cartoons for the Charlotte Observer for 15 years, and PTL has been located near outside of Charlotte, and so that was a local cartoon for me. I mean, that was a local issue, and I've been making fun of PTL before it was cool to make fun of PTL.
Has it been easier for you to satirize televangelism as someone who's doing it from the inside, because these are people who you grew up with?
That's right. I mean, you know, you grow up with a lot of stuff, and it's not only the ironies of religious professional life, but you know, my job as a cartoonist is to pick out or to ferret out those ironies and to see those and what you develop a kind of a skill at that. And so when you combine the world of that old-time religion with that prime-time religion, you know, you're going to get a lot of ironies. I mean, it's a long way from a manger in Bethlehem to a water slide in Heritage USA. I mean, there's Heritage Village. That is there's a lot of humor potential, a lot of irony potential. And so, I guess it comes naturally to me, having grown up with that. But it's all there.
How did you first develop Reverend Wilby Dunn, who's the main character for your new book?
Well, I you know, the preacher Wilby Dunn is the minister to the citizens of Bypass in the comic strip Kudzu. He's kind of the resident guru and truth sayer. But it comes out of my experience. I mean, I grew up Southern Baptist in Mississippi and North Carolina, and when you grow up in small towns, there's always, you know, in the South, religion is sort of the backdrop, and you develop a familiarity, particularly if you grow up Southern Baptist, where you go to church a lot. And I was sitting in a revival meeting when the minister at this church was preaching on and using the recurring theme that the world is in chaos. He kept repeating, "The world is in chaos." And I was only 12 years old, but I knew that the word was chaos. And so, you know, that was, I knew that there was an authority needed to be questioned at this point. And that, I guess that's the beginning of my history as a cartoonist, as a satirist, and particularly drawing preachers.
You recently created a couple of characters who were parodies of Jim and Tammy Baker, and your parody characters are called Jim and Tammy Bankroll, and there's a new scandal that you've introduced, and it's Mascara Scam. Can you explain what that is?
Well, basically, you know, the way Mascara Scam developed is that Tammy Faye Bankroll was on the mascara wing at Betty Ford, and she gave an interview to Robin Leach on Lifestyles of the Rich and Vacuous, and she accused Wilby Dunn of being the person who turned her on to the pleasures of eyeliner and mascara, and of course Wilby Dunn had to defend himself, and things kind of degenerated from there.
I wonder if Tammy Baker is more upset with the fun that you're making of her use of cosmetics and with the fact that you draw her as being very chubby. I wonder if she's more upset about that than she is about the political implications of what you're writing.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you're around PTL, when you go, you know, as I said, I've drawn cartoons about them for a long time. When you live in Charlotte, you became immune, at least I became, and most people around, to all of the excesses. You become so saturated with this bizarreness that you accept it. So the nation is kind of discovering what we had kind of grown used to. And one of the things that you learn is that if you saw them on Nightline, that these folks are profoundly naive. I mean, there's this kind of a childish quality or emotionally immature quality that where you get in trouble and then either Yahweh or a new set of accountants or Jerry Falwell or some daddy comes in and takes care of things. I think this time the Bakers are in trouble because Jerry Falwell is trashing them.
What's the most controversial strip that you had Reverend Will be done in?
Well, the strip was banned. It was banned in Tulsa because, and not for a particular strip, although I've drawn the brother Oral, but it was actually just the idea of having ministers making fun of them. The local newspaper in Tulsa caved in to the fundamentalists and the followers of Brother Oral Roberts because they didn't like the idea of ministers being made fun of.
Would you ever pick up the phone and call up an editor to complain if they don't run one of your cartoons because it's too controversial?
That's a good idea. I've never done that. It's all part of, part of the cartoonist-editor relationship is, the great thing about free speech is that, I get to say outrageous things and editors get to squelch it. I have
great
a right
bargain,
to do that,
huh?
And they have a right to run things or not run them in their newspapers, and I'm in favor of that.
Reverend Will B. Dunn has thrown his hat into the ring. He's running for president. What do you think his chances are?
Probably as good as most of the Democrats. and many of them, one might consider cartoon characters, so who knows?
Are you sending out reporters to see if they can dig up any sexual scandals in his past?
Yes. Well, he's in seclusion now in a double wide on the outskirts of Bypass in a trailer park, and the only people he's talking to is his rubber ducky, Mr. Quackers. But you'll have to stay tuned.
I have to ask you a question that's about the strip, but it's unrelated to the televangelist satires that we've been discussing. Mm-hmm. This is the question of chest hair. Now, in your new book, the character Kudzu asks if it's possible to get a chest hair implant. I take it he doesn't have enough chest hair.
That's right. This is
now. Is this something you identify with?
This is getting kind of personal. I mean, it's okay for me to talk about preachers and other people and radio talk show hosts, but I mean, you're not supposed to ask personal questions to cartoonists.
You're covering up. You don't have a lot
I'm
of chest hair.
I'm covering up.
I can tell.
No pun intended. No, I do not. I want to make it clear, and this is a good opportunity, that I do not wear a chest wig. It is it's true. I don't. I do have chest hair. Both of them are well groomed, and the strip is kind of based on my experience as a teenager, and all of those things. Those things, bodily hair and functions, and those things are fascinating to you when you're an adolescent and have a great deal of meaning. And Kudzu, I guess, is that expresses that aspect of my experience as a failed teenager. And nothing is fails as much as not growing pubic hair, pubescent hair, maybe we should say, chest hair. Or any of that stuff, I was about 5 years behind all of my my friends going through puberty, so I identify with Kudzu's problems.
So you feel in a way you're still working out things from when you were a teenager.
Oh, sure, isn't everybody? I mean, I think that's one of the reasons the strip is so basic. What I realized as I grew out of my quote teenage years. Is that I came to realize that everyone is still a teenager, everyone's still a child, and everyone's still adolescent. And so by having these characters play out these issues, it remains everyone's business. And the fact that Kudzu is an adolescent is definitely an expression of mine and everybody else's adolescence.
Doug Marlette, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Cartoonist Doug Marlette's new book is called There's No Business Like Soul Business, featuring the Reverend Will B. Dunn. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story are you following today?
Well, we're following the International Economic Summit in Venice and also the Iran-Contra hearings in Washington, D.C. Today, testimony from Fawn Hall, who is formerly a personal secretary to Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North on the National Security Council. And in addition, we'll be hearing about a new movie called Personal Services.
Yes, that's about a now-famous British woman who ran a brothel for older men.
Indeed, and the real-life British woman, the Madam, will be interviewed by Renee Montaigne, and also Bob Mondello will have a review.
Okay, well, thank you, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This weekend, after a nearly 13-year run, the radio show A Prairie Home Companion will broadcast its final new program. Many fans will be able to see the last show without having to be in the World Theater in St. Paul. Our television critic David Bianculli has the thoughts on the sights and sounds of A Prairie Home Companion.
If you've never seen Prairie Home Companion, this is your last chance before it goes into reruns. For the last 16 weeks, Garrison Keillor's show has been available on a 3-hour delayed basis to viewers of cable TV's The Disney Channel. This Saturday's finale will be shown too, and even if you don't get the Disney Channel, a TV version will soon be within reach. Advance orders are already being taken for video cassettes of the farewell show. Many people think that radio is a special kind of child, one that should be heard but not seen. Parts of the televised show, though, are well worth watching. It's a sad jolt at first to see the messy stage at St. Paul's World Theater, with all its wires, empty chairs, and constant aimless movement. It looks more like they're conducting a sound check rather than broadcasting a live, nationwide radio show. But the looseness, above all, is what makes the program so charming. On the plus side, it's fun to see the soap opera skits acted out with their attendant sound effects, especially on Buster the Show Dog. And certain guests are as enjoyable to see as to hear. Bobby McFerrin showed up recently to sing all by himself most of the music from The Wizard of Oz. He used his body as well as his voice. One minute he was flapping his wings as the Good Witch. The next he was on his knees as a munchkin. Score one for television. Then again, there's something less than comfortable about watching Keillor when he sings with some of his guests. Recently he was harmonizing with the Everly Brothers, and his expression made it look like this was something forced on him, like an after-school punishment. Now you know that the Everly Brothers wouldn't be there if Keillor didn't like them, so what his face was showing was probably shyness more than anything else. Once I noticed that, I began closing my eyes whenever Keillor was singing with a special guest. What I heard with my eyes shut wasn't the best singing voice in the world, but there were no traces of nervousness. Score one for radio. But the Lake Wobegon segments are impervious to television. TV cameras can't diminish Keillor's strength as a talker, and that's what counts. In hardback and paperback, Keillor's stories have sold millions of copies because reading them, you can mentally supply Keillor's voice, complete with those delicious, deliberate pauses and deep breaths. Keillor is good in print and better on television, but I think radio is the perfect medium for his particular talent. He works from the barest of notes for his monologues and just sort of talks. His voice is wonderful, soothing. You can tell by listening to him that he's a radio guy, just as you can tell by listening to me that I'm a newspaper guy. Normally, this is the point where I'd insert a sound clip from the TV show to let you hear for yourself what Keillor sounds like. But robbed of the picture, that would be like listening to Keillor on the radio, and I don't think there's a public radio listener in the country who couldn't pick Keillor's voice out of a lineup. So what I'll do instead is just repeat what Keillor said a few weeks ago during his Lake Wobegon news segment. He told his audience, those in the St. Paul Theater, those listening to radio, and those watching on the Disney Channel, that he wasn't leaving us. He was rejoining us. It was a beautiful thing to say, even if I don't buy it for a second. I'll miss him, on TV and on my radio. And almost everyone I know will too. He proved at the end that TV could do justice to radio. And that's the news about Lake Wobegon, where all the women are, well, you know the rest.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post.
Oh, look who's coming through that door. I think we met somewhere before. Hello, love. Hello, love. Oh, where in the world have you been so long? I've missed you so since you've been gone. Hello, love. Oh, hello, everybody, and welcome to A Prairie Home.
Here's a preview of our next program. On our next show, I'll speak with actor and film director Robert Townsend. His movie Hollywood Shuffle is a comedy about the stereotyped roles Hollywood offers black actors. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will look at the Orioles, the first black doo-wop group to achieve mainstream success. And book critic John Leonard will review Life and Death in Shanghai, Yan Cheng's account of her imprisonment during the Chinese Cultural Revolution. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to hear from you. Write to us with your comments and suggestions. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.